Dexter. Dexter has the Hunter One background.
Right.
Yeah, that's why he keeps getting away with all this crap.
Dangerous Easter Egg Hunt in New York City. I'm your host, Shane.
And I'm your host, Ishan.
And welcome to episode 34 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about why we play RPGs, and specifically, D&D. But first, the party gets a history lesson in the Morning Glory campaign, and the Sister of Battle fights fire and everything else with fire in the Character Creation Forge.
So Ishan, before we get to all that, Curse of Strahd was released March 15th.
And last week, yeah.
Yeah, and the reviews are starting to come in.
In general, they seem pretty good.
Yeah, everybody really likes it.
Now, my question is, do they really like it because it's actually very good, or is it nostalgia?
Well, I don't
or,
know.
Or, hey, it's something that's not Forgotten Realms.
That might be part of it, and we were talking about it earlier. I think that's probably the reason I'm going to buy it either way, is to support non-Forgotten Realms. And encourage wizards to look at other campaign settings.
It's an excellent plan.
I don't know. I don't have a way to measure if it's nostalgia or not because I never played the original Curse of Strahd. So I don't even know how similar or different it would be.
I mean, I'll admit I didn't play that particular adventure either. I did a bunch of stuff in Ravenloft, and I'm pretty familiar with Strahd himself.
Yeah.
From what I can tell, it seems to capture the flavor of it very well. There's a bunch of information. It's over 250 pages long.
That's a big module.
Yeah, and there's an adventure for PCs level 1 to 10, which, okay, first off, I'm thinking, at level 10 they can face Strahd? Really?
Maybe you don't face Strahd.
Yeah, yeah, I'll need to take a look at that, because I want a stat block.
Right.
But there are also plenty of appendices and a bunch of additional information about Ravenloft, maps, things like that, and locations that aren't necessarily just the castle.
Yeah, and then there's some player options, too. There's the Haunted One background and a table of gothic trinkets,
right?
Which I love tables, so.
But of course, if you want those, you don't have to buy the whole book for it. Wizards released it for free online.
Yeah, it's the Curse of Strahd character options PDF. If you search for it, it's easy to find.
Mm-hmm. Haunted One is a pretty cool background, and you pointed out maybe broken.
Yeah, it's the first background ability that's possibly OP. So the Haunted One is somebody who's seen or done something so terrible that it lingers as a darkness in you. And so part of it is establishing what the harrowing event was, and then you are granted the feature Heart of Darkness. Though they might fear you, commoners will extend you every courtesy and do their utmost to help you. Unless you have shown yourself to be a danger to them, they will even take up arms to fight alongside you should you find yourself facing an enemy alone.
This is even stronger than noble, right, where like commoners defer to you, or folk hero, where commoners will shelter you. They'll fight for you. Get followers.
Yeah, this is just straight followers. And you've got to kill any haunted one you run into so that you can take his followers.
They can be only one.
Right. So the Haunted Highlander, I think, is a great character arc.
Who just continually amasses more commoners.
Right. But yeah, no, I think it's a super flavorful kind of fits Ravenloft really well, if you take the cheesiness aside.
Mm-hmm. It also looks like if you don't even necessarily want to play Ravenloft or have anything to do with this adventure with Strahd, if you want any kind of gothic horror or even just adventures that are, you know, a bit more grimdark, there's a lot of information here that you can port over to your own campaign.
Yeah, and don't think that background specifically is really even limited to Ravenloft. Looking through the tables for the harrowing event and the different personality traits and whatnot, none of that is Ravenloft specific.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as you have generally evil things running around in the setting, it would totally fit.
And if you don't, then
get a better setting.
Right.
What are we doing here? All right, let's move on to the Morning Glory campaign.
So, after finally receiving a bunch of magic items from the Celestials of New Metrol, and then poring over a new prophecy that the angels helped them uncover after they wrangled it out of Behemoth, the party does what it does best, and goes to the library for some research.
We are really good at research.
You guys were great at it, and it was awesome for me as a GM because you guys were always like, okay, we need to know what's going on. Lore, it's time for lore. And I was like, yes, handouts. I made them.
So the thing that was really cool about that with our party is we had three characters who, through one means or another, had high investigation and knowledge skills, right? Mm-hmm. Either they were int-based or they had expertise in those types of skills. Mm-hmm. So we had those bases covered. And then on top of that, we had wisdom-based characters that were able to kind of synthesize as well. Mm-hmm. So research time was not wasted time at all. Like, everyone was involved, even though it seems like it should be boring.
Yeah, even the paladin and the monk, as players, were very interested in the lore.
Yeah.
So anything that was uncovered by the more sage-type characters, the players themselves were like, wait, hold on, let's take a look at this.
Right, right.
Which was awesome. So I had introduced as a member of the jury that had found you to be innocent, a planetar named Hroan, who it had come out during the trial was a sage, specifically was sort of like the go-to person for figuring out information about the long history of Eberron.
Yeah, apparently he was also a Boston Brahmin. Sorry, that name.
Yes. Yes, he was. And green. Also green.
Sorry, I interrupted.
No, it's good. Okay. During the trial, actually, he hit it off quite a bit with Lou because they both like to talk about sagey type stuff, even though she tried to recruit him to her cult. And he said, I will perhaps take a look at this and get back to you.
Right, right. Yeah. I'll call you. Don't call me.
But so he compiled a bunch of information about the kinds of threats that you were facing. You specifically asked about, okay, we need to know about Rakshasas. We need to know about these overlords because apparently they exist and that's real. And you know, tell us about fiends in general. We need to know how to kill them. So he compiled all this information and then gave it to you. And I gave it to you guys in the form of these documents that I put together that, you know, sort of looked like parchments. So the first one was of overlords and fiends, and all of these I specifically targeted not just to give you a bunch of lore like to throw at you so like you're more immersed in my setting, but they had information that you needed in order to further the plot. So for example, the sort of dossier on overlords and fiends told you that in the same way as angels are immortal creatures, powerful fiends are sort of the same thing. They can't be killed permanently. They can only be bound, which is what happened with the Silver Flame. Or if their physical bodies are destroyed, they just sort of reform back in the depths of Kyber, Eberron's Underdark.
And that's part of Eberron, right?
Right.
That's just how Eberron was written.
Exactly. And particularly powerful ones, when they reform, they can retain a lot of their memories. So in general, there's sort of this steady state, you know, like a low-level Archon gets killed. Okay, another Archon reforms out of the stuff of the plane. And that's sort of like a general D&D thing, but also very Eberron specific. And then if you're a very powerful one, you actually just sort of pop back up with your memories intact and like start from where you were before.
Right. Yeah. All of your grudges are intact.
Exactly. So the unique thing that I introduced was what we ended up calling death conditions, which was that the Draconic Prophecy, which we talked about last episode, sort of is a GM fiat way of being able to decide why things do or don't happen. Inside the Draconic Prophecy, there are clues as to a very specific set of death conditions that can be met in order to kill a particular immortal. And so you guys knew, here's our quest. Find the death conditions for any of these immortals that we need to kill. It also gave you information on the Rakshasa specifically and the Lords of Dust, and gave you more information about Belshalor, the Shadow in the Flame, the specific fiend that you knew that you were sort of up against right now.
Which I think brought us to the Lords of Dust.
Yeah, because your more immediate issue to deal with was you knew that Nishim Shadar, the Rakshasa, was still out there somewhere. Because you'd killed him 4 years prior, and now you knew that he definitely wasn't totally dead. And
dead, dead.
Yeah. Right. And now you're like, oh, okay, that's why we killed him here. But then in our past / his future, he was still like walking around. Why was that?
Yeah.
Right. It's because he can't really die.
Jerk.
Although you did ruin all his stuff.
Yeah. So there's that. I mean, yeah. We started to level the scoreboard a little bit.
Yes.
So we're clawing it back late in the third quarter.
So there was some information about, and it was canon information about how the Lords of Dust, the Rakshasas, each serve a particular fiendish overlord, and so they're all sort of working on their own to help release them, or some of them even to like keep them from being released, because they sort of enjoy not having anyone in control of them.
Yeah, that's what I love about the Lords of Dust, is that and this is sort of what I love about anytime you have this large evil kind of congregation, right, is that the backstabbing amongst themselves keeps them from being so overwhelming,
right?
But I just love like the way the personalities highlight, it's like, I'm supposed to be helping you, I'm going to do that really slowly because I kind of like my job by myself. I got like a wife and kids, you know?
That's right. I'm hanging over here for a bit.
Right.
I mean, you're sleeping. You're sleeping.
Yeah. Who's going to know?
And then I also gave you guys a bunch of backstory information on the history of the Eberron multiverse, the creation myths, which is readily available with like player supplements and things like that, but it also became very necessary information for you guys to have in terms of being able to interpret properly the prophecies that I was giving you.
Yeah, I don't know how in line the information you gave us was with the published setting.
Very close, for the most part.
That's what I figured. It was helpful as a player, as a person, right, to not have to divorce setting knowledge from character knowledge at that point, because we're getting deep into like setting myth and lore. So lining those things back up and giving the information to our characters made it much easier as players to not, you know, because like we had kind of suspected the Lords of Dust when we saw the Rakshasa, but we didn't have a reason to name the Lords of Dust as characters.
And it was which is why pretty quickly after all of these things started to come out in game, I wanted to give you guys an opportunity to just have someone give all that to you.
Right. Like confirm the suspicion sort of thing. Yeah,
exactly. And then the information that you got about the creation myth, the important points were that there were the three primordial dragons. There, one of them killed another.
This is Sybaris, Eberron, and Kyber.
Exactly. Kyber kills Sybaris. That creates magic. Eberron wraps herself around Kyber, traps her forever. Kyber births the demons. The emergence of the overlords. There was a war with the dragons and the Quaddles sacrificed themselves and actually create the Silver Flame, which then tied in for you guys. Oh, okay. All of the fiendish overlords are bound by what humanoids tend to call the Silver Flame, which is sort of a small piece of this much larger force.
Thus validating Bran's religious beliefs.
There was a link between Sybaris, who he thought was calling to him from beyond the grave, and the Silver Flame, his old god.
Right. which made him less of a heretic and right back into being in the Inquisition now.
He did sort of rededicate himself. Right. Oh, wait, hold on.
Yeah, it was like, okay, all right, well, that was an odd detour, but we're back on track.
I still have scales, though.
Yeah. I've got the scales, but I'm going to go kill some shifters again.
I got the scales. I got the skills. Let's do this.
Right.
So now that you had all this information, you needed to figure out how to actually move the plot forward. You had to get out of here, you know, because it was the dimensional lock on the entire area, which is, of course, why the angels hadn't been able to just teleport away.
Mm-hmm.
And they had presented you with two potential options. Walking to the left into Dol Ur, the plane of the dead, or walking to the right into Maybar, the plane of negative energy and undeath.
What was the difference in walking one way or the other?
So in determining what happened in either of these planes, I had established that the Mornland was created from a convergence of the two planes. And we know that there are sort of very bad effects that happen in the Mornland. There's a despair effect. You know, it's sort of difficult to care about things. It's difficult to heal. Things don't rot. Things like that. So I actually split those two so that in Dol Ur, the realm of the dead, that had the despair effect. So you knew that if you walked in that direction, it would be difficult for you guys to succeed at particular tasks, just depending on, you know, how well you were able to resist those effects. And if you walked into Maybar, you knew that you wouldn't be able to heal. And so since you had dealt with both of those when you were in the Moorland, you all said, healing is something we want to be able to do.
Yeah.
Let's go to Dol Ur.
Right.
But there also were caveats on it.
Yeah, a couple dangers lurking in either plane.
If you head toward Dol Ur, the angels were like, okay, yeah, look out for ghosts, but also avoid the corpse collector.
Right.
And if you go into Maybar, avoid the nightshade. And you guys were like, what information can you give us about that? And the angels were like, well, you'll see it. Just leave.
Yeah. Thanks. thanks. You know, just on a quest to save the multiverse. You know, no big deal here. Don't just let us die to the corpse collector.
Yeah, the point of it was really so that you guys, you were very powerful now, right? Level 14, maybe level 15 at this point, and dealing with world-shaking events. But I still wanted you to know that there are sort of forces of nature out there that even like these very powerful angels are saying, just avoid it. Don't right. do that.
Right. There's some places even angels won't go, right?
But fools.
Right. Silly, softy humanoids.
So we'll find out what happens in Dolur next week.
Okay, so on to our main topic. Why do we play RPGs and why do we play D&D specifically?
It's obviously because we don't have any friends.
Definitely that.
Yeah.
It's really just us two hanging out, playing games, and then recording about it.
Guys.
And our four imaginary friends.
I just right. Jim. We do the voices. So the reason that we're talking about this episode, it's not all solipsistic navel gazing. The point is to help our listeners figure out how to talk to people who don't play this hobby about our hobby.
Yeah, it's to share all the things that we love about it, so that you can perhaps carry that forward to your friends who are into video games but have never played a traditional role-playing game, mm-hmm. or board gamers who've never played a role-playing game, right. or actors and comedians who've never played a role-playing game, right? I mean, there's a huge cross-section.
Yeah,
any creative gamer type, it's great.
Or just your loved ones who are like, wait, a what? I don't understand what you do.
Play D&D with your mom. I promise, if nothing else, it'll be entertaining.
Yep, play D&D with Shane's mom.
Somebody has to.
It is also an opportunity to sort of come out of the closet. I mean, we grew up in I guess you grew up in the 90s.
I did grow up in the 90s, yes.
I grew up in the 80s. But in any case, it wasn't a very cool hobby at the time.
It's still not a cool hobby.
Not particularly, yeah. It is. I do find it strange that it seems more normal for people to play World of Warcraft.
Yeah. But as geek culture kind of comes more into the mainstream, I think talking about role-playing games more openly is less strange. Like, when I do mention role-playing games to people, in D&D specifically, I get a little more curiosity now than I used to. When I first started, it was kind of that thing you just didn't talk about.
Yeah.
Because it had all these negative associations, right? We were still in sort of, well, I mean, it was easier for me than it was for you, but we still had the satanic scare and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So now it's like, oh, so it's like Game of Thrones?
Yeah, right?
Like Lord of the Rings? Oh, okay, I get it, yeah. And there's like funny dice?
Okay, so I think in order to put in a context why we play, it makes sense to talk about how long we've been playing. So, Shane, when did you start RPGs and D&D?
I think it was 16 years ago now. I've mentioned a couple times I started with Warhammer 40K. It was my first foray into tabletop hobbies.
Oh, right.
And yeah. Then picked up D&D after playing Baldur's Gate. I grabbed the AD&D Core Rules 2.0 CD-ROM, which was all of the core books and main splat books for AD&D 2nd Edition in one disc.
All in one place, like Encarta.
Yeah, it was like Encarta for D&D. Yeah, and I mean, I sat at my computer screen reading that like crazy. And then eventually finally played 3rd Edition. So it took like 2 years to finally play.
So you kind of segued into it via 40K.
Yeah, I guess they were, yeah, sort of. So I got into tabletop games through 40K, right? Mm-hmm. Like started going to those kinds of stores mm-hmm. to buy 40K. And then when I played Baldur's Gate, it had big D&D branding all over it. Mm-hmm. I also played Magic the Gathering and used to read Inquest magazine, RIP. And that talked about card games and role-playing games. So I was exposed to role-playing games as IPs long before I ever actually played one. So I knew what D&D was. I knew what L5R was, those kind of things.
Yeah, I think a lot of us sort of come to this sideways. There's some other nerdy hobby that's a little more mainstream, mm-hmm. and we meet people, and then like they play D&D, and so we just sort of like hop on that bandwagon.
Right.
And that's what happened to me. I was playing Magic the Gathering. I saw some people playing it in like early high school, and I was like, what is this? This is super cool. And then, you know, I went to the comic book shop because that's where the Magic games were taking place. So mm-hmm. record my so-called life and then go off to the comic book shop.
Which meant actually having to hit record on a VCR.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You had to rewind the tape to make sure you had room. Yeah, I remember that.
But I met a bunch of people there who were also playing Magic who I started to hang out with, and they, on the weekends, would like go to each other's basements and play D&D. And so I just sort of like tagged along with that. And then, honestly, like I found D&D a lot more immersive and interesting. You know, it was a lot more imaginative. I still liked Magic, but, you know, when I stopped playing Magic like 3 years later, I still stuck to D&D.
Yeah, same thing for me. Magic got exhausting to keep up with and mm-hmm. is extremely expensive. Yeah. Right?
That's basically it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, people sometimes complain about 3.5, like a splat book every month. Oh, that's really expensive. But that was nothing compared to booster packs.
No, and I mean, my parents loved it because I was actually reading books, right? In high school. And I mean, you know, I had school books and stuff too, but it wasn't like I sat down and read novels for fun, mm-hmm. right? So at least they would like thumb through it and be like, well, I mean, at least it's real words, you know, like, it's not worse than a fantasy novel, I guess, you know,
often good vocabulary words.
Right. Right.
This will be good for his SATs.
You know, it didn't hurt.
He knows how to pronounce melee.
Right.
I don't know that Arquebus is really useful, but okay.
Who knows?
Right.
Who knows?
Never know. It's making a comeback too.
Right.
Okay. So you've been doing it for 16 years. I've been at it for 20. Why are we still playing? Shouldn't we have grown out of it by now?
You know, when I started playing in high school, I thought I would. Oh. I really think I did think I'd grow out of it in the same way that I thought I would grow out of video games. Because I looked at my parents. They never did any of this.
Right.
And I thought, yeah, I mean, eventually, like, I'll be an adult and stop.
Oh, you thought, oh, I'm going to turn into those people?
I mean, you don't most kids?
Yeah, it depends on the parents.
Okay, yeah. Depending on how much you hate your parents as a kid. Yeah, fair enough. But for me, it was... As the amount of time that I have to actually spend with friends has decreased, the meaningfulness of that time becomes more important. Mm-hmm. And so I love that role-playing games are so interactive and social.
I think probably everyone listening, and certainly both of us, spent a long time playing CRPGs, computer role-playing games.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Whether that was like something with like kind of a story like Diablo or, you know, something more immersive like Baldur's Gate or Neverwinter Nights.
Yeah. For me, it was usually online games. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was spending less and less time playing the game mm-hmm. and more time participating in the community aspects.
Right. RPing right? in the forum or, yeah.
I was never really into role play, but like getting in the chat and like BSing about the game was,
or even about builds or whatever.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. Being engaged in a community was way more important to me than actually running and doing another bail run in Diablo 2.
Right.
Or doing the bail run with my friends. Right. And then talking about it at school the next morning uh-huh. was more fun. Right.
Yeah. So I think certainly after all these years, that's what draws me and you to this is the interactivity, being able to sit around a table with people that you know and you like, and to play a game in a way that is more interactive than even some of the newer board games.
Yeah. And I will say, more so than I ever have before in probably the past year, I've stopped only playing with friends, right? Mm. I mean, mm-hmm. I joined our group without knowing anybody there. That was just sort of a random addition from the internet, right? Mm-hmm. And became friends with the group. And then since that, I started playing at conventions. I started playing online. And it stopped being about spending time with people I already knew. And it kind of became a thing about meeting new people as well.
I think you have a problem, Shane.
I know. I don't have enough friends.
You just, every night, you're just out looking for a game. I just need a game, man.
I just got to get my fix. Somebody give me a game.
Actually, I kind of feel the same way. It's sort of the reason that like I joined so many play-by-post
games. Yeah, don't give me crap. You play-by-post all the time.
I will say it's a little different because you're right. It's almost more immersive because like I don't know these people in real life. I don't even know actual names because we all go by handles on forums.
Right, right.
You know? So like the most I might know about somebody is previous games that they've played in.
Exactly.
You know?
Yep.
And so like there's not a lot of crosstalk or table chat. Because there's like an out of character forum that you could talk
right.
in, but usually that's like, hold on, roll these dice or whatever. It's almost exclusively in character talking.
Yep.
I'm glad I don't have to like look at people while we do exclusively in character talking. No real names.
Right. But it's not just the social aspects, right?
Yeah.
There's also substantive elements of RPGs themselves, like engaging in epic plots.
I mean, I think that's the main reason that most of us sort of got into this in the first place. We read Tolkien and went, that's awesome. I'm definitely going to be Aragorn. I'm not going to be one of the halflings. Forget that.
I mean, you know that I started to read it and then put it down because it's garbage. Well, but still wanted to finish the story myself.
That's because you couldn't get past the songs.
Because I quit after Tom Bombadil. I'm not ashamed to admit it. Look, we cataloged an old halfling's whole house, and then we get Tom Bombadil, and you want me to finish three more books? I'm out.
See, it's exactly RPGs.
It's true.
You know, Tom Bombadil never gave up on you. He's still out there.
Yeah, but he didn't show up in the movie, did he?
That's because he didn't need to?
I rest my case. Okay, back to the topic.
Okay.
So, and I think part of that epic plot, right, is that the storytelling is cooperative. It's not one person's story. It's not writing a novel. It's not fan fiction. It's a group of people sort of cooperating to build a plot and build a story, being led and facilitated by a game master.
Right. As someone who, like, I am a writer for a living, and I also write fiction, it's so much less painful than actually, like, outlining and writing out an entire story on your own for a sort of faceless audience.
Yeah, it's extremely low cost.
Yeah.
The amount of effort required to get very entertaining results is comparatively low.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you plan more than 4 hours for a 4-hour session, you're on this crazy high end of the scale.
Yeah.
You know, and we probably plan maybe an hour or so for a session at this point.
In aggregate, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd say so. It takes longer to write a prophecy, but.
Well, yeah. I mean, you had a little bit larger plot stuff to handle at times.
But I will say, so on both sides of the screen, as a GM and as a player, in general, everyone's sort of interested in these engaging plots that eventually grow larger and larger so that the characters, as they grow in power, can really feel like they're making a difference in the world that they inhabit.
Right.
And I think that kind of scale is something that you can do at a table and in a small intimate group much more easily and much more immersively than you can even in something like a giant blockbuster movie, you know? Like, you can go see The Avengers and all 19 of its sequels. And, like, that's very cool, and there's a very large scale, and there are many things happening. There's an alien invasion,
mm-hmm.
but at the end of the day, you got to watch Iron Man fight it off the invasion.
Right, right. You know? You could be Iron Man.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you could sit down and watch 6 seasons of Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could just start over playing Ned Stark.
Yeah.
And maybe, spoiler, maybe you don't die at the end of the first season. Right?
Yeah, maybe you can make the right decisions.
Exactly.
Right. Or also fail, but, like, own that failure.
Yeah, and fail in your own epic way. Mm-hmm. Right.
I think something that not everybody loves about RPGs, but it's certainly something that we're into, is the tactical aspect of them.
I would actually even walk that a step back, the game aspect of them,
mm-hmm.
right? There's the tactical combat sort of stuff. I think we also enjoy the character building mechanical standpoint.
Right. In-game and out of game.
The crunchy bits. We like doing that analysis of the value of this skill over this skill or this feat or this choice. And then in the game, how we apply those skills in fun and interesting and, you know, character-defining ways is also exciting.
Yeah, one thing that I find very rewarding is taking, you know, numbers on a sheet or class features that define in a gamist way abilities and things that my character can do, and then expressing them through roleplay in a way that makes sense in the world and then still comes across as, like, very immersive and cool.
I mean, that's kind of one of the bases of the character creation forge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is how do you take these abstract mechanics and turn them into a concept that isn't necessarily sitting in the pages already.
Right. Or flowing the other way. You know, how do you take this amazing concept that you have and make it work in game?
Right.
Without just throwing the rules out so that, you know, you have no idea if things are going to be balanced.
And then there's the lore.
The lore. We have played games that we don't even really like because we love the lore.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're not wrong.
One of my favorite things is a new splat book or source book for, maybe it's a game I play, maybe it's a game I don't play, but just reading it like a novel.
Yeah, I mean, I've bought every single book in the Dark Heresy second edition line because I just like the lore.
Mm-hmm.
And reading 40K lore is fun. I'm reading the Gaunt's Ghosts series. I'm on novel 11 of 13.
Wait, already?
Yeah. It's just, I like the lore, right? And mm-hmm. and so as I go through that, right, that's the stuff that I'm drawing inspiration from
mm-hmm.
in our campaign. So, I mean, the that immersiveness, the feeling of a world that's so much bigger than what your characters are directly exposed to, is so fantastic.
Yeah, I like that it's sort of a long-term version of the amazing parts of sci-fi or fantasy movies, the world building.
Right? Right.
At the beginning, you see, oh, like, here's a Shire, and then, oh, holy crap, there are like these weird riders and elves with magic, and those are sprinkled throughout a long series of like epic movies, or, you know, the reveal in The Matrix.
Right.
Where, oh, okay, this is a world that is sort of based on our own, but is very different because of these particular reasons. And now I'm getting to see almost a behind the scenes version of that. I like that reading lore and getting immersed in lore is just, it's almost like taking the good bits out.
Right, right. You
know, it's the polio string cheese version of the pizza.
Wow.
Polio string cheese is terrible.
You mentioned The Matrix, and that makes me think of a conversation that I had with some friends afterwards that's, I think, common with sci-fi and speculative fiction, right? Where you take the premise and you modify the premise slightly, and you kind of do that thought exercise of what would be different? What if Tony Stark hadn't been part of the Iron Man?
Mm-hmm.
Or, sorry, hadn't been part of the Avengers? Role-playing games give you a way to explore that without having to sit down and do it yourself as fan fiction, right?
Yeah, like actually have to sort of connect all those threads. It's often done for you.
Right, right. But there are lots of RPGs, and yes, we play D&D, not exclusively, but I think for both of us, it always comes back to D&D. That's the game that's sitting on our shelf that's always ready to go whenever we need it.
I mean, if the dice gods came down from on high and said, you must now choose only one RPG to ever play again, I'd pick D&D.
I'd pick D&D.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not because it's the best game, because it's the best written game, because it is the most fun game necessarily, but there are reasons that I would pick D&D.
Yeah. And it's probably similar for a lot of the people who play.
Yeah.
For us, you know, 16, 20 years of playing this game, there's a lot of nostalgia.
Yeah. I mean, when it's the first game you play, and and if you're a gamer of a certain age who's been playing for a certain amount of time, it may have been one of just a few options at the time you started playing, and probably the best marketed option.
Right.
I don't know. Is that a little bit of inertia, maybe?
Maybe. Perhaps.
A game system in motion tends to stay in motion.
Until it splits into two component parts, and then Pathfinder continues in a different direction.
Oh, well, yeah, fair enough.
But D&D, and particularly now, but honestly through most of its life cycle, has had really excellent product support. Whether you liked the support that you were getting, a little different, but there's always been a lot of it.
Yeah, the business model has changed.
Mm-hmm.
The focus of the different editions has changed over time, of course, but one thing you can't say about them is that they didn't support their product when it was on the shelf.
Yeah.
Right.
Even back in second edition, already we can see they're beginning to recycle some of the ideas for new player options.
Yep.
Right. They put out kits, or even I started with second edition and with skills and powers, which was just an addendum to essentially your ability scores, which gave you a really granular way to define how those were portrayed in game that people were sort of clamoring for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then 3.5 book a month.
Yeah, it seemed like it was even faster.
And then at the time, really excellent forums, RIP.
Yeah, I mean, I think the community around D&D is another big selling point for me. It's just there are so many D&D players just by virtue of its scale and the popularity of the product that there are forums, there are conventions, there are just this vast amount of resources dedicated to it. And like any community, it has its share of bad apples, and because it's gaming, probably more than most. But the best members of the community are so great, right? Guys like Keith Baker, who are still engaged in their settings so many years after they're done being published.
Mm-hmm.
They set this great example, this kind of beacon of hope. And so I love that there are people that have that level of investment and devotion in the work that they do and the games that we play to share it with other people.
Mm-hmm. If you are talking to someone who has never experienced any of this before, they're more likely to recognize the name Dungeons & Dragons than they are RPG. They'll probably go, why rocket-propelled grenades? What's wrong with you?
Right. Yeah, I play Call of Duty.
And so even people who do play RPGs who don't like D&D, and you know, there's a substantial number of those people out there, they've all played it, most likely.
Yeah, Yeah, usually. It's a common thread. You can always compare things to D&D and have a fair comparison. Apocalypse mm-hmm. World is like D&D, except in all of the ways it isn't, right? GURPS is like D&D, except for whatever, right? There's some really innovative games that don't map well. I'm thinking Fiasco, mm-hmm. right? Nothing like D&D. The dice don't matter. But I bet a lot of Fiasco players know what D&D is.
Yeah. I don't know that there's a huge community of like exclusive Fiasco players.
True. And I think all of this adds together to just this vast amount of analysis that's been done on D&D at every edition, right? There are people who have put so much time and effort into figuring it out, but it's not solved, right? It's not like chess. Well, chess is maybe a bad example, but chess. or it's not like Settlers of Catan, where there's an optimal strategy. You've solved the game, right? You either play that strategy or you don't. I think D&D is still broad enough and, frankly, unbalanced enough that there are elements, there are pockets, there's still value to be added intellectually.
You can see this from the vast numbers of people online who are crunching the numbers and building spreadsheets and comparing, you know, one feat's damage output versus another. There isn't necessarily a consensus about what's the best thing to do, because the answer is usually, well, it kind of depends on what you want your character to be able to do. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I spent a ton of time on the character optimization forums, and those people were brilliant with this stuff. But yeah, when it really came down to it, it was up to you.
And then D&D has tons of homebrew available too. So if you're bored with what you see in the book, there are plenty of people out there who have tried to hack the game.
Yeah, we've talked about before, as a GM, it's actually relatively easy to sort of tweak the dials. As a player, it's obviously a little more difficult because D&D sort of has this class structure when you're building a character.
Mm-hmm.
And certain editions of the game are a lot more difficult to optimize or customize.
Mm-hmm.
But I think 5e does a pretty good job of traveling the middle ground there.
Yeah, I mean, 5e is actually a quality game. There are some editions of D&D where you really couldn't say it was the best game on the market.
Right.
Or even necessarily a good game on the market. Not naming any names, fourth edition. But I think 5e is a worthwhile entry into the design lexicon of role-playing games.
Yeah, and I think, you know, once you sort of get used to 5e, if you want to get into something that's a lot more granular or that enables you to change many more things, then you can branch out from there. But in general, D&D is it's a great touchstone. And I think most people do come back to it at times.
Yeah. And well, the other side of that is I think you can lighten up 5e as well. You don't need all the mechanics, right? You can strip it down if you're more into a story type game.
You can flip it upside down, go back to Thaco.
You have the GM roll all the dice.
A few GM intrusions.
And then for me, and this is kind of feeding into that nostalgia, but absolutely the way that I think is in D&D levels. When I track power level in fantasy games, or honestly in most games, I'm thinking of level 1, helpless, likely to die, to level 20, demigod, right? And it's that increment of level is how I think of things. Whether it's level 70 in World of Warcraft and fully geared, or it's having 10,000 XP in 40K. I'm still tracking along that scale. It's the yardstick.
So you're extrapolating and doing the math on, okay, really, I'm a level 15 D&D character.
I mean, doing the math is a stretch, but but I know what it feels like to be a level 15 character, right? Mm-hmm. So if it feels like that, that's how I kind of map it.
I definitely actually do that with media. Like if I'm watching a movie, that guy's a level 7 fighter.
Exactly. Yeah, it's totally... Oh, yeah, he's making 3 attacks a round.
That's right. Look at him.
Got to be level 11.
That's right. She's bending reality. Yeah, but isn't perfect at it? Okay, you're not level 17.
Right.
You're probably level 15 wizard. Because you're like, ugh, level 8 spells? Crap.
Yeah. So let's open it up to our listeners. Why do you guys play D&D? What is it about D&D that appeals to you? Is it just that it was the first thing you've played, or is there something that drew you to D&D after playing other games? Do you hear that, Ishan?
I think it's the sound of me leveling up.
It is, which means it's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge. Before we do that, let's tell our listeners how to get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne, that's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
You can also email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And last but not least, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So, this week in the Character Creation Forge, we promised you a Sister of Battle from Warhammer 40K.
Ishan, what is a Sister of Battle from Warhammer 40K?
It's a nun with a gun.
That is, yes. It's also a terrible marketing attempt by Games Workshop to make 40K appealing to women.
Yeah, really terrible.
Very 90s. So
very drow.
Yeah. So in canon, Sisters of Battle are nuns, religious fanatics, so devoted to the Emperor and cleansing the Imperium of heretics that they are fanatical warrior monks. Mm-hmm. They're known for their power armor, but they're extremely lithe and dexterous, you know, because cliche women.
Right.
And then they use the cleansing flames of Prometheum to burn heretics.
Right.
Not always at the stake. Sometimes just on the field of combat.
They're so fanatical that they've developed an immunity to the taint of chaos.
Right. They're all insane. Like, literally.
Yeah. I mean, most people in general in 40K are pretty insane, but they're double insane.
Right. Like, they go more crazy instead of becoming corrupted. Mm-hmm. Right. And so they're kind of the basis of the armor of contempt, right? Like, if you hate chaos enough, it can't hurt you.
So how do we map that in D&D?
Well, we need fire.
Right.
And if there is one thing that fits a Sister of Battle, it's a barbarian rage. You know, you threaten the Empire or the Emperor, you threaten the Imperium. You're going to piss them off. They're not stable.
Right. Her pupils disappear. There's right. A little bit of foam.
Right. Yep. Right. So it sounds like barbarian, right? Mm-hmm. It's the only way to rage. But barbarians can't cast spells to get the fire element while Uh-oh. Raging. But you know what can?
What?
Sun Soul Monk.
What?
Which fits warrior monk, mm-hmm. right?
Ascetic lifestyle.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You get all of the benefits of monk weapons, right? So you don't have to necessarily be a hand-to-hand. You don't have to necessarily be the empty-handed monk. You can use swords, daggers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But then you can throw fire as non-spells. It's just a ranged attack.
Ranged spell attack, but right. It's not casting a spell.
Right.
Right. And it's interesting here, we pick Bear Totem for the barbarian because the sisters can usually take a bunch of damage just because they're so devoted. The frenzy barb, the
Path of the Berserker.
Yes, that one. It works thematically really well, but all that you get at level 3 is the ability to make an extra attack with a bonus action. But we're already getting that from Sun Soul Monk, and we're getting better than that.
And it has to be a strength attack.
Yeah.
Which, lame.
So the actual build, Sun Soul Monk 17, Barbarian 3.
And this will be Bear Totem, so that you're getting, when you rage, you'll get resistance against all damage, except psychic.
Right, perfect.
Which I like. Uh-huh. You know, that's the weakness.
Mm-hmm. Yes, if the Emperor wants to take apart your mind,
right,
he can.
Right.
And, of course, if a sister misses and it's you with her Prometheum, it's cool.
It's fine. You're probably a heretic.
Yeah.
If you hadn't been a heretic, she wouldn't have hit you.
She didn't burn. Definitely a heretic.
Right. And then Sun Soul Monk gives you lots of monk goodies.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, the sisters aren't always in their massive power armor with their huge bolters. Sometimes they're actually just operating in the darkness and the shadows as assassins. So this allows them to do that as well. And while the sisters aren't psychers, they often exhibit almost supernatural abilities. Acts of faith, because their faith in the Emperor of Mankind is so strong. And I think that's really well reflected with key points and the sort of pseudo-magical things you can do with key.
Yeah. The other thing that I like with the Sun Soul Monk is that a lot of its abilities actually use radiant damage,
mm-hmm.
which almost feels a little more like, you know, inspired by the Emperor than fire necessarily would, even though canonically, right, they do use holy flamers.
Although maybe Prometheum does radiant damage.
It's possible. But at level 11, the Sun Soul Monk gets Searing Sunburst, which basically lets them throw a fireball that is not casting a spell.
Radiant Ball.
Right, Radiant Ball.
In the far future, obviously the Mechanicus picks damage types that fewer things are resistant to.
Right. And then at 17th level, they get Sun Shield, which causes radiant damage to any creature that hits you, and also sheds the Emperor's Holy Light in a radius around you.
I mean, who would dare lift a hand against a sister?
Only a heretic.
And they will be struck down.
Exactly. By her and her compatriots. So how do we fit our Sun Soul Monk Barbarian 3 Sister of Battle into a traditional D&D campaign? Obviously, this works if you're trying to play D&D 40K. That's an uphill battle. For me, I think the easiest way to do this is to substitute the Emperor for a God of Light.
Mm.
Just do kind of a one-for-one switch. And if you can find one who's particularly militant in the process, like perhaps the God of Justice or something like that, who's going to demand the righteous path and forge it with sword or magic, however it must be done, right? Then I think that's a perfect fitting for a Sister of Battle. So I would go with someone who starts as a monk at a monastery devoted to that deity. So it's sort of always a religious aspect. And then as part of that training, they develop the barbarian instincts of resisting through self-flagellation.
So since you took the raised in a monastery and now out adventuring route, I'm going to go the other side.
Oh, okay.
And say that she's, well, in 40K terms, she would be a feral worlder.
Okay.
But so I would say maybe Outlander background, yep. Grew up in a barbarian tribe, and that's where she learned, you know, the ability to rage and the ability to have wholly devoted faith in something.
The sun, literally,
yes,
the sun.
Yes, the sun. It's there. It's right there.
Right. It gives us light and warmth. What more do you need? I will share its light and warmth with everyone who opposes.
That's right. Through my hands.
Right.
And I think her talents are discovered after she leaves the tribe. And then is brought into the fold of a monastery.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to neglect the monastery entirely and take the monk as less of an actual order and more of sort of a personal discipline kind of, you know, almost like the tribe elder sort of thing, right? Like almost a more shamanic kind of...
Oh, I see where you're going with that.
Tribe member, right?
So learned on her own.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the platonic ideal of their tribe, right, in worshiping the sun, and she becomes that sort of icon.
Does she become worshipped by the tribe?
I don't know.
I bet she's often worshipped by the tribe, and then she kills that person.
Oh, right, because yeah, I mean that's heresy. I'm not the sun.
I'm standing right here.
Right,
the sun is right there.
Right, you can see the sun. I am but a beacon. I am but a channeler of the sun's great power.
Your punishment. Look at it. Keep looking at it.
I do like that. I think it would be really interesting if you made her blind. It's difficult to pull off in D&D because blind sense isn't easy to get.
Yes, if you don't just make it, you know, a hand wavy, oh, she's blind,
right,
kind of thing.
Right.
You'd need a familiar. You could lose a few levels a monk, though, and maybe for some warlock for a familiar whose eyes you can see through.
Yeah.
It's 10 levels of rogue, I think, to get blind sense.
Yeah, it's not great. But I do at least the idea that you would punish people, right, by forcing them to stare at the sun. Like maybe that blindness would be a punishment, right?
Or that's how you gain superpowers, like Pete and Pete. I was also alive in the 90s.
Yeah, but you were grown up.
Ish.
All right. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you're willing to help us out and leave a review, we'll read it on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about playing dwarven characters in the next installment of our series on playing particular non-human races.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
Well, we're building a dwarven defender.
Well, that's it for episode 34 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.